A warm welcome to new listeners and old friends. This is the latest episode of Talking Golf.
Because all the researchers have suggested that someone who's got a more mastery orientation mindset, their resilience and the stability in their self-confidence is going to be a lot more stable than someone who's predominantly ego-oriented.
Yeah. Bit of a first for Talking Golf, and we're broadcasting live from the US Open at Shinnecock Hills. I'm here with my great friend Lee Crumbleholm, who is, I think I'm right in saying, a sports psychologist. Is that
correct?
The official term?
Yep.
His company is called Winning Golf Mind. He works with a bundle of players on European Tour, a couple of guys on PGA Tour, and you've got three guys here this week, is that right?
Yeah, we've got Kiradek, Ross Fisher, and James Morrison.
Excellent. So, given we're at the toughest of all events, or theoretically the toughest of all events, at, I think, probably the toughest course that I have coached at in major golf, is your preparation with the players this week any different to other weeks?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is for a US Open. I love the US Open. I think it just, the mental side gets amplified on a week like this.
It does seem to produce a very specific type of player in terms of winners, doesn't it?
It does. They're very gritty.
Yeah, calm, tenacious.
Yeah, there's all kinds of different challenges going on. You have to deal with adversity so much more on a week like this at the US Open than probably any other tournament. For a number of reasons, really. I mean, I remember my first one was at the Olympic Club in San Francisco a few years ago. And I was there with a couple of guys, Brandon Grace and Matt Baldwin. And what we talked about there was, I know it's a bit of a cliche in sports psychology, but kind of staying in the process.
Yep.
And what we mean by that is kind of, if you make a bogey, then hopefully it doesn't affect what you actually do on your next shot. Primarily, your emotional side has to be kind of under control, under management, not getting too wound up,
yep,
basically. Because that's what these golf courses and the USGA in particular want to happen.
Because they want level par to win.
They want level par to win, ideally.
Yeah. Yep.
So making bogeys this week is fine. It's going to happen, even doubles. But it's then the reaction after that is the key factor, in my opinion.
Yep. No, I totally agree. So we've had various discussions with players and coaches and caddies about what type of player will win this week, and it's all related to whether they're long hitters, straight hitters, good iron players, good chippers, good putters. Frankly, I think you need to be pretty good at everything if you're going to have a chance this week.
Yeah.
What's the ideal mindset to play a US Open and give yourself the best chance of winning?
I think you have to be optimistic. You know, and by that I mean when you stand there over every shot, you've got to believe that you can actually pull that shot off.
Yeah.
The key thing for me is when you have those critical moments where you might be fighting to make the cut, you might be fighting to win the tournament, even on a Friday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday or Sunday. You know, there's a disaster around every corner because obviously we've been out on the golf course and the rough is
brutal.
It's brutal. But it's quite generous off the tee, so I think it's more of a second shot course. And around the greens, they could manipulate the golf course. At Olympic Club, the scoring was quite decent on Thursday. And overnight, I've never seen a golf course change so much. It was unbelievable. It was a new experience for me.
And they experienced something similar here in 04 when they lost the seventh hole, effectively.
Yes. I mean, Chambers Bay, everything was just lost before everyone got there, which is a shame. When you're faced with that challenge, you can either go into yourself or get frustrated and get angry and let that then carry over into the next few holes, or you can just go, do you know what? I knew there was potential for this to happen, so let's just kind of keep the optimism there. Keep your emotions in check, really.
It's so difficult, but I think one of the great challenges of the game of golf from a mental perspective is you are so focused on yourself that you sometimes lose sight of the fact that what you're experiencing is probably going to be experienced by everyone else in the field at some point during 4 days round 7,500 yards of hell, torture.
It's a beautiful golf course, Hugh.
It is
fantastic.
Fabulous.
It's very fair. If you hit it straight off the tee, then you'll be fine until you get to the greens.
Until you get to the greens. Where you're going to putt off at least two of them.
Absolutely, a day.
I said to someone the other day that if you're a member here, you'd quit the game. You could literally spend a year playing once a week and never make a birdie.
What about Oakmont?
True, yeah, another monster.
Oakmont is set up to US Open standards every week for the members.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
They slow the greens down when the pros come to
One of the members was very proud about telling me that at Oakmont. Oh, these greens are so slow compared to how we have it. They must have a very big psychiatrist couch in the clubhouse at Oakmont.
Well, or a big bar.
Yeah.
So go back to the challenge of the Greens here, because I have to confess, I've never seen, including Augusta, I've never seen a championship setup where the Greens are so difficult, penal. I don't know what the right word is for it, because there's ultimately...
Challenging.
Yeah. There's at least six holes out there where I can't see more than two pin positions.
Yeah.
11, for example, I think you could have 20 feet between your left flag and your right flag.
Correct, yeah.
Seven being the same. How do you get players to prepare themselves for a defensive putting week?
There's certainly going to be a lot of 20, 30, 40 footers out there, isn't there? So what we've been doing is kind of working a lot on lag putts, quite difficult because the practice putting green isn't that big, and holing out from 6 and 7 feet, because there's going to be a lot of 6 and 7 foot putts. I think the guy who puts well from kind of 6 and 7 feet and in is going to do well.
Definitely, you know, going to be a contender.
They're going to be gaining on putts gained and all those kind of stats. So, and really, you know, getting the players prepped to know that that is going to happen, you know, so it doesn't become a shock to them when after 9 holes they've had 5 putts from 7 feet to save par. That's actually going to be perceived as being normal.
That's probably the norm. Absolutely.
That's what everyone else is doing. So it's kind of prepping them a little bit for that, I would say, on the greens. And there is going to be 3 putts out there because, like I say, you know, there's some positions where they might have found a flat spot, but you wouldn't have any chance of getting it close to the hole. So the patience thing, I know it's, you know, get patient, get focused, have acceptance. But they're all massively relevant week in, week out on European Tour, PGA Tour. But everything just gets amplified at the US Open.
And it's interesting, although, as you say, the patience, the focus, the stay in the present sounds very cliched, they're basically sports or golf psychology fundamentals. They're not cliches. That's fundamental to being successful at this game.
What I've always said is there's a reason why things like that are cliches.
Yeah.
And any cliche in any walk of life is because it's a repetitive thing. It's the same kind of thing. It becomes the norm, and then people flick it onto under a cliche label, and then for some reason it gets a bit of negativity. But it's a bloody cliche because it happens all of the time, and it's necessary all of the time.
So how do you, I mean, looking at the players you work with back in Europe, and even the 3 players you've got here this week are pretty diverse personalities. I mean, Ross is an incredibly laid-back human being. James is full of energy, full of life. Don't know Kiradek that well to comment, but how can you get such diverse human beings better at the same skills?
First and foremost, what I encourage with the players is to match up their off-course personality on the golf course with someone who's laid back off the golf course. I would want them to be laid back on the golf course. And that, that seems cliché-ish and obvious, but it doesn't always happen.
Absolutely right, yeah.
You know, you get some players who are calm but then fiery on the golf course, and someone like Kiradek, when I was brought in to work with him a couple of years ago, my main goal was to get him to smile again, because he's a naturally happy, chirpy person, but he was miserable on the golf course. That's how I would want Kiradek on the golf course. We'd want James to match his own off-course personality on the golf course, and the same with Ross. But underlying those things are, I've got this 3-level framework that I've created and what I use. Level 3 is all of the processes and behaviours. And this is for anyone. It's not just for tour players. This is for... I've presented this at golf clubs and the golf club members love it.
I'd like to come back to a little bit later.
Level 3 is all the kind of processes, you know, your pre-shot routines, mental pre-shot routines, your course management, your decisiveness, decisions, all those kind of things. Now, below that is level 2, what I call the attitude level, which a lot of it becomes your motivational orientation, which is not how much you're motivated.
You're going to certainly need to explain that to me, I suspect most of the listeners.
Yeah, it's like, it sounds psychobabble-ish, but it's actually quite a simple concept. So it's motivational orientation. It's not how much someone is motivated. It's their underlying reasons for motivation. So is the club player wanting to play in the club championship and do well in the club championship so they can sit there in the bar afterwards like a peacock and go, I've beaten everyone else? Or do they want to play in the club championship because they know there's extra perceived pressure, but they were able to handle that situation more effectively? So the guy who sits in the clubhouse having a beer thinking that he's just won the Open Championship, that's a more ego mindset. Yeah. And a more mastery mindset is the person who just wants to challenge himself against the golf course, or herself, and be able to play the shots and think clearly. So it's almost a kind of master process versus outcome.
And
but with
there's not really, I mean, one thing I've learned over the years coaching at every level is it's impossible to question someone's motivation, because they're all motivated, as you point out, they're all motivated in so many different ways.
Yes.
And one thing we hear out here all the time is, well, if you're motivated by money, then that's the wrong motivation.
Yeah.
Well, actually, for a lot of people, that is the case.
Yeah, definitely. And
it's not our position to question it. Right. It's our position to help them understand how to manage that particular characteristic.
Yeah.
That, to me, is the same as having blue eyes or being left-handed.
Yeah.
Your part of your golfing DNA, if you like.
Yeah, that's right. And what I kind of bring to the table a little bit with that is, if they are motivated by the money and all those kind of things, then I can show them the potential pitfalls of being too much like that, and then try and get some more balance. Because all the researchers have suggested that someone who's got a more mastery orientation mindset, their resilience and the stability in their self-confidence is going to be a lot more stable than someone who's predominantly ego-oriented. Yeah. That's in that kind of level two attitude level. Then beneath that, we've got what I call the biological level. So we look at the way the blood flows around the brain. You know, when there is a perceived threat, does the player deal with it effectively, or do they go into fight, flight, or freeze?
Yep.
So that's particularly relevant at a US Open or a club championship, or when a club player is about to break 80 for the first time, or 90, you know, there's a perceived threat there. We need to reduce the perceived threat, and we do that through various ways of helping them manage the mind, but also not just the blood flow around the brain. We also look at the brain waves. So we have a thing called the focus band.
Yep, you've got technology to help you with this.
Yeah. It makes people look like a tennis player, and then you get some people, some of the more comical players out here on tour, mate, passing comment. But
and the comical coaches.
And the comical coaches, yeah. Says Hugh Marr with an inordinately large pair of headphones on his head.
Yeah, sat in the corner of a player's lounge.
With the brainwave stuff, what we do is we're looking to get players to start to engage the subconscious mind with focused eyes.
Yep.
A really good way of doing that, and that's something that I really get a lot of players to try and do, is ask effective questions all of the time.
Yep.
So they might be stood on the 11th tee where it's just basically a shelf with a 20-foot square landing area, and to the right and to the left, it all falls away. So rather than
and the back and the front.
And the back and the front, yeah. So rather than them standing there going, oh, I really hope I hit this green, or what if I miss this green, that would be an ineffective question. You know, an effective question in that mental pre-shot routine would be, okay, where's my ideal landing point here? What's my ideal start line? How do I see or feel this ball flight going in with this crosswind and all those kind of things? So that's where, when I said at the beginning, you know, a player needs to be optimistic. The way that the player questions themselves mentally will encourage optimism.
And do you engage the caddy in this process as well?
Definitely.
That's still one thing that I'm surprised at out here, is there's not more energy, resource put into training caddies to be effective co-drivers. Because ultimately, they're the only people when your balls are in your back of your throat, when you're stood there with everything on the line, they're the only person that can have an impact one way or t'other.
They're the psychologist on the golf course. They're the coach. Sometimes they're the coach. You know, they're the punch bag.
Yeah, and there's definitely an attitude in golf that the caddy isn't really a particularly skilled role, or it's not. I couldn't disagree with that more.
Absolutely. And I do a lot of work with the caddies. We talk about, there was one of the players in Italy that I worked with, Andy Sullivan. He was a little bit erratic with his pitching. So I got his caddy, who's obviously a very good caddy, Macca, to ask a different question.
And he was a good player as well.
He was a good player. And I actually used to work with him when he played. We changed the question on the pitching to something more specific, and all of a sudden, the wedges just started getting dialed in. So the importance of the caddy is massive, and that's why I do quite a bit of work with the caddies, to be honest.
Okay, so I'm going to take a slightly different tack now, because you've talked about what you view as sort of key skills for high performers. We've both worked with youngsters who, by and large, aren't born with these skills. How important are the mental skills you talk about when a player is growing up? Because we read all these articles about helicopter parenting and the good coaching versus bad coaching for youngsters. How would you take... Well, let's make it two questions. Number one, what would you do differently with young players? Is there a need to introduce them to these skills
The younger the better.
Okay.
The younger the better, definitely.
Well, how about the second question then? How would you shape an environment for a young player to develop these skills? That's maybe a better way of looking at it.
I think you do a lot of it around kind of setting challenges in practice, kind of like what you and I do out here. You know, there's different types of coaches out here. You know, there's some guys who will do predominantly just the technique, and then there's others who go down the more performance route. So setting challenges for a youngster, things that they can certainly achieve, but they will find a challenge in there. So that's the skill, is finding the right level. Yeah, I was doing a putting drill yesterday on the putting green with one of the guys, and I actually set it up too tough. I realised quite quickly that I'd set it up too tough, so we just adapted it straight away, and you get buy-in because the players trust you.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
So, and it would be exactly the same with younger players. You know, a lot of challenge. Don't lose your fundamental golf swing that you have. Just tweak it. Not everyone's going to swing it like Rory McIlroy because, you know, Rory's just blessed that he's got a beautiful golf swing.
And he didn't try and swing it like that. That's
no,
the way
he just copied probably watching guys on the TV or at his golf club.
That was his interpretation of a golf swing.
Yeah, it's the old cliche, would you coach Jim Furyk out of his golf swing? Well, if you would, then you'd be crazy, wouldn't you? So,
a very good story about when I think he was looking to be signed by a couple of big colleges, and the coach of one of the potential colleges said to Jim's father, Mike, who's his, been his only coach,
yeah,
I can't wait to get Jim here so we can change that golf swing. And, and his father's response was, well, he won't be coming here.
I love that.
So talking about practice environments, because I'm a massive believer, particularly with youngsters, that making practice what I call effective,
yeah,
is crucial. It has to be, there has to be context to it. There has to be feedback to it. It has to challenge not just the physical or the technical skills, but also the intellectual skills.
Yeah.
And the player must have a process after that to understand what's happened and create a pathway to get better. That's how I view effective practice.
Yeah, yeah.
And as a kid, that's the only way I practiced. I wasn't a ball beater. I just like, well, I've got to get the ball close to this flag and I'm going to figure out the best way for me to do it.
Yeah.
Do you have any specific drills, games that you use with players to do that, or are you just throwing ideas at them on the spur of a moment?
Again, it depends on the player. So the kind of drills would be adapted to the different types of player and different types of personality. What I do is I like to set up challenges that are tough.
Yeah.
Because what we're inadvertently generating with them without them realising is resilience to
create those roadblocks.
Create the roadblocks, yeah. And then they're actually learning that mental skill. So it doesn't matter what drill you set up, as long as it's just on the edge.
But it must be relevant.
Got to be relevant.
It must be relevant. It must be in context.
Yes.
I'm seeing lots of stuff being posted on social media that just doesn't make sense to me as a golf drill. How's that making them a better golfer? Again, whether it's lack of context or lack of feedback or out here, it's certainly better than it was when I started out here maybe 10 or 11 years ago, though it was very much a culture of ball beaters. And while there's still plenty of them,
yeah,
there's definitely a shift towards more performance-focused practice, more exploring more what Dave Brailsford would call the 1% accumulators.
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of that, to be honest, has come from, there's more kind of psychologists down here, but also the stuff that Jordan Spieth has worked on since he was a junior has been very well documented.
And that, to me, is a fabulous player coach.
That's Jordan. Cameron McCormick.
McCormick, yeah.
They're always doing challenges. They've always done challenges. You know, you look at Jordan Spieth's golf swing, you wouldn't necessarily copy it.
Not necessarily, no.
Because it's not textbook. But when we talked earlier about, you know, grit and determination and what he did at the Open Championship last year when he blew it right onto the range,
yeah,
off the back of what he'd just done at the Masters previously, where he made a mess of the 12th hole.
Have you ever seen a 24, 25-year-old handle a situation like that in such a composed fashion?
Not since Tiger.
Correct. He dictated everything that happened in that 25-minute period and handled it with incredible class, incredible dignity.
Yeah. He had a choice. He could either think back to the Masters, where he ballsed it up, and think, oh, here we go again, or he could go, do you know what? I'm going to stand up here and I'm going to take ownership of this situation and I'm going to do the business. And if it comes off, it comes off. And that's a great mindset.
And bear in mind, he spent 3 hours leading up to that point where he really hadn't hit a shot.
No,
he putted terribly. And funnily enough, Torbjörn played a practice round with him on the Wednesday of that week. And Cameron McCormick was out, so I got a chance to chat with Cameron. And I was fascinated by the places that Jordan chose to practice from.
Right, okay.
Just the most obscure places. I'm like, Cameron, why on earth would you be practicing off a downslope in knee-high rough to a short flag. So it's not necessarily the situation we're practicing, we're just giving him a tough challenge that he has to process and stand up to.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
It is. They've done an amazing job, and fair play to the pair of them, because it's what they have created is a player that pretty much can deal with any kind of situation.
100%. And they all have Michael Dicati, Cameron, they all play a specific role in it.
Oh, they're all in on it.
And yeah. They all understand exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
But also fair play to the parents who've understood that taking a step back and entrusting this young man, this very talented, clearly, young yes. man's development to someone else entirely. I mean, that's increasingly unusual.
Yeah, and in different parts of the world, it's quite different as well. Yeah. You know, we see a lot of, over in Asia, there's a lot of parental intervention, isn't there?
Yeah.
You know, we kind of see that.
I wouldn't even say intervention. It's it's a dictatorship sometimes, isn't it?
Yes.
This is what you do, and there's no questioning why you do it.
Yeah.
Fascinating. So let's finish off by talking a little bit about how you could help a club player. Number one, is what you offer something that is exclusively for elite players, or is this something that you think would help your average Joe at the local club?
Well, I know 100% that it helps everyone, because, you know, obviously I've not always been sat in players' lounges at US Open, so, you know, kind of 10 years ago, 14 years ago, whenever it was, well, it's actually more than that, it's about 20 years ago when I started, you know, I didn't all of a sudden end up plying my trade on the European Tour. I was working with club players and helping them improve, getting from 27 to 20 and all those kind of things. So,
and how much do you think that helps shape you as a coach?
That's huge. I used to work in all the different sports, and I did that consciously. You know, I worked with gymnasts, I worked with in rugby, I worked in hockey, you know, in national squads, and I did that intentionally to see how they functioned and, you know, how they worked and how they communicated. Because, you know, if you go in too narrow, then you're not getting a proper education. You know, my number two, Tom King, who works alongside me, you know, he's been working at the Leicester City Football Academy 2 days a week whilst he's been coming to the end of his training. And it's invaluable, you know, it's absolutely superb. You know, he's going to go down the golf route eventually, kind of full time. But at the moment, you know, he's getting a very broad education on psychology in different sports.
And it's something that, I mean, from my experience, I got frustrated by my lack of progress with better players early in my career. And now, 20 years down the line, I look back and I'm like, well, actually, I wasn't ready to coach out here when I started coaching out here.
Yeah.
There is not a quicker learning curve in sport, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely.
As soon as you get out in front of these guys, it is just different.
It is, because you can't hide anywhere.
No.
Because you're with them so much more than you would be a player back home.
By and large, they all have a fairly effective BS filter, and they're not afraid to call you on it when...
Yeah, well, how are we still managing to get work out here then?
There's a fabulous episode of The Simpsons where Homer loses his job at the brewery, and after a couple of days of feeling miserable, Marge says to him, so how are we going to earn money? Homer's reply was, well, I'm going to teach the piano. Well, you've never played the piano in your life, Homer. He says, yeah, all you got to do is stay one lesson ahead of the pupil.
Love that. That'll be about right. Back to the club players. Yes, I mean, absolutely. When I first started doing this, I was obviously working with club players, and then started working with EuroPro players, and then Challenge Tour players, and then national squads, and then European Tour. And I lost my European Tour card a few times, you know, over the years. But with club players, it's exactly the same stuff, because it's all relative. A professional golfer's level par is level par. With some players, it's 3 under. With other players, it's 2 over. But a club player, you know, 20 handicaps, their level par is 20 over. So it's absolutely the same. And there is very little difference between the mindsets of club players, because it's all relative to tour players. I hear the same stuff back at my club where I'm based at as I do out here. It's exactly the same.
And we can never lose sight of the fact we're dealing with human beings.
Yes.
We all function in the same way.
Yeah.
We all have the same frailties, neuroses. We all have to deal with similar things on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. And, you know, the hopes and dreams side of it as well, you know.
Yeah.
It's just a lot of club players, especially the youngsters, you know, they want to get down to single figures as soon as possible, and then that creates a challenge. And then they want to get down to plus one so they can get in the massive, you know, junior tournaments and all that. And it's exactly the same. They become score-obsessed, handicap-obsessed. And it's the same with a 20 handicapper who's trying to break 80 for the first time. You know, it's the same human being type person and traits that are going on as we have out here in a, you know, one of the four majors. So we can help any level of player in sports psychology.
So let's finish up then. You've got one piece of advice you'd offer to all of our club golf listeners.
Yeah.
What would it be?
One of the fundamentals in my work is to ask effective questions. I think, you know, it's so important to get you focused on the task at hand in the moment, in the present. So asking an effective question. If you've got a 15-foot putt, rather than just trying to hit a 15-foot putt, ask the question, where do I want to start it to hole it? You know, something like that. So it's a loaded question. It's engaging this. You start to engage the subconscious.
Yep.
On a difficult tee shot without a bounce down the right, rather than going, or don't hit it down the right, it's, okay, what does a really good shot look like here? What's a really good start target down the left side, you know? And so asking effective questions like that. And if you've got a plugged ball in a bunker, rather than say, oh, I'm not going to be able to get this out, it's like, that. How can I get this onto the green? So just asking effective questions.
Yeah, what I call can-do questions.
Yeah, absolutely. If there's one takeaway from this, it would be ask effective questions for me. That would be one of the key things.
Brilliant. Lee, thank you very much. I know that you've got to
thank
go and do some
much.
Work now.
Yep.
I think Torbjörn's just wandered off to the putting green, so I'm going to be called upon to get my coach's hat on.
Brilliant. Pleasure
Have a great week.
Yeah, and you, mate.
I'd love to maybe carry on this conversation at some point soon. We'll take it in a different direction and explore some other stuff.
Perfect. Sounds good.
Thank you, mate.
Thanks, bud.
Take care.
Cheers.